Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Abington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to this edition of the War Report. As you know, I am on the road. I just returned this morning, a few hours ago, from yesterday. I was in both Connecticut. And then from Connecticut into Massachusetts, and spent the night in Massachusetts, and got back to Connecticut in time for the show just a few hours ago. And I will tell you more about that when we do the last 10 minutes, and I'll try and give everyone an update in terms of what has happened this week on the road trip. The show today came about as a result of participating in the TED Talk that took place this past Wednesday. Most of you know about this already. The show was billed as the Magnificent Seven, and there was seven of us who gave our individual talks, different subject matter, different themes, and et cetera. But two of the talkers, which I didn't know what they were going to be talking about in any specific detail, we're talking about War Report themes. And their talks just blew me away. I'll have more to say about that. I mean, really, I was surprised because I didn't have any idea what they were going to be talking about. And it just was incredible to be so surprised. So then, of course, I did my talk, and I instantly decided that if it was any way possible, I would invite these two guests to come on the show and sort of like redo a mini version of our TEDx talks, giving you somewhat of a early preview of the full-blown talks that would be available, they said, 2 weeks from the day that we did the talks. So that was the 14th, so sometime toward the end of this month. Okay, with that in place, let me go to my two guests. I'm going to just give their names and then, of course, have them give a little more about them. And then I'm probably going to add some more to their brief discussion of who they are and what they've done and et cetera. One of our guests is Dr. And she I want to like draw this out a little bit. Dr. Denny Taylor. She is a professor emeritus of Literacy Studies from Hofstra University, and she's founder of a publication called, I can't remember exactly what it was, Denny, and you'll tell us the name of your press that you put out, and I'm going to just stop at there. Our next guest is Dr. Ricardo Rosa. He's a professor at University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. He's also an author. And we're going to talk about that a little bit, too. Both of these individuals are extremely dynamite activists, advocates, and they have blazed a trail in their own right. And let's get right to them. Welcome, Denny. Welcome, Ricardo.
James, thank you so much. And hi to Ricardo as well. I think you, Ricardo, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hello, Denny, and thank you.
Hi.
Thank you so much for this invitation, James. I appreciate it.
Did you want me to talk first?
No. Did I surprise you guys when I got in touch with you and told you that I wanted to do this show and I wanted you both to be a guest?
It was very nice
Absolutely.
Of you. I appreciate it.
I do things like that. Let me say something about Denny. Her area is basically what I guess the general thing is now called climate change issues. And some may say, well, what does that have to do with the war report and the war on public education? I don't say it in the intro that you hear from Deborah, but that was kind of left out a year and a half ago. But in putting this show together, I use the phrase, and I've used it many, 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 many times on the show, that the neoliberal ultimate agenda, the Machiavellian agenda, is the privatization of everyone and everything, all of humanity and the planet. Now, I haven't gotten to the planet part yet. We have been working with the all of humanity, and specifically as it relates to public education. But I most definitely include the privatization of our planet by the corporate elite political power structure that has emerged over the last, as we said, 35 years here. And so Denny is going to be talking about that, and it's not out of place. It's a topic that she could come on any show that we've done previously and shows in the future, because the privatization of the planet is one of my big concerns. With that, Denny, let's maybe talk a little bit more about you and then about your talk.
Okay, James, thank you so much. I think that probably what's the most important is that I am a teacher, and I began teaching in the 60s, so I've actually been involved with public education for 5 decades. And I'm also an anthropologist, so much of my work has focused on schools and families and kids, and really looking at how language is used in communities as well as in schools. And so those are things that I've written about for a very long time. And I guess about 20 years ago, I've always worked with in struggling communities. I became really involved in catastrophic events and looking at mass trauma and how children and families cope when events happen. And that's the work that has led me into looking at what scientists call anthropogenic change. And so really in the last 20 years, I've been involved in the physical sciences as well as the social sciences. But, you know, my message for schools is always that, you know, let's make our schools spill over with vitality and intellectual curiosity, where kids can smile and laugh, and where they cannot get enough of discovery and learning, knowing that, you know, this is a reimagining of schooling for our children. They need a chance to overcome the problems that we've heaped upon them. And I mean, the biggest problem that we've heaped upon them, above all other problems, is the anthropogenic changes that are taking place to the planet. So I'm kind of caught between education and climate, and trying to bring those two together. And that's really what I try to do in my TED Talk. So It focused on what about the kids tackling climate change for our children. And the message is pretty grim as far as the response of governments, especially the U.S. government, to climate change. I mean, the climate deniers in Congress are also the people in power who want to privatize public education. So scientists are being vilified and are having a difficult time, and teachers are having a difficult time, and partly because their vision for children is very different than the vision of power brokers who are determining what happens in our schools. So my key message is never doubt the power of the people to respond when their children are in peril. And I think that's the driving force of everything I do, is that it's communities, it's parents, it's teachers who stand by kids when there are enormous problems that need to be faced. And of course, the most pressing issues are around the Common Core and high stakes testing and the privatization of public schools. I mean, these are in the moment very difficult issues that parents and teachers are facing. But then there's this other layer. Because we have moved out of, scientists are very clear, we've moved out of the last 10,000 years of the Holocene, and we're now in transition to another state. So, and that state, scientists call the Anthropocene, because this is the first time in history that it's a remarkable moment, because this is the first time that people have the capacity to determine the future of the planet. We are literally changing the geology of the planet by the ways in which we're living on it. And I quoted in my talk Martin Rees, the astrophysicist, who has said that this is the first time in 45 million years one species, the human species, has the capacity to determine the future of the planet. So there, in that speech, and this is a very difficult stuff to present, because we're all tired. I mean, we're all dealing with what's happening in schools, and when we're caught in the moment, and so there isn't time for teachers, parents, to say, okay, so how can we prepare our kids for the changes that are taking place in the long term? Because we're just trying to survive in the moment. But what scientists say is that and it's unequivocal, the Earth system has moved out well outside the range of natural variability and is currently operating in a non-analog state. So scientists know things are changing. We don't know how fast they're changing. They think they're changing faster than we have previously thought. And the magnitude of the changes are unprecedented. So in 2007, a group of Nobel laureates got together in Potsdam in Germany and put out a statement, which it's easy to download, but one of the sentences in there I used in my talk, which is that humanity is standing at a moment in history when great transformation is needed to respond to the immense threat to Earth. I want to say I'm speechless. I cannot figure out why. And I think I am no different than many, many, many people within society who cannot figure out why the government isn't acting. If we knew that there was going to be an asteroid in 50 years' time, we would be preparing for that asteroid. But we are not preparing for the kinds of changes, the extreme weather patterns, the possibility of the Arctic ice melting. We're not preparing our children. It seems that the reason that schools stay the same is because there is so much power and so much wealth caught up in the anthropogenic way of living on the planet that it's hard for those in power to give up their positionality when that's what's going to have to happen. There are now reports out that say that the very rich are really going to have to think about their footprint on the planet. And we know, indisputable, this is coming from scientists across the world, that equality is absolutely critical to the future of human life on the planet. And I hope I'm not going on too long, but the last thing I would say is that we know historically that when societies change, the place they change first is in schools. So to me, it makes enormous sense, and I think the research supports it, that we have to rethink public education, and we have to make schools places where kids can use their imagination, that they are problem solving, and that they're not being prepared to live, they're not being prepared to participate in an anthropogenic workforce when we're saying we've got to change the way that we live on the planet. So it seems to me that there are immediate reasons to change the ways kids are taught in public school, because they've become inhumane places. They're just places where kids are being tested ad nauseum and on a curriculum that has absolutely no foundation in research. It is developmentally inappropriate, and so many different groups have come out and said that. So we have this, you know, it's a training ground for a way of life that we have to rethink, and we have to rethink rapidly. And just to go back to it, it's the idea that our schools need to be filled with vitality, that they're part of a revisioning of the future, you know, and caring for our kids should be like the oxygen we breathe. And we really, to me, the groups that are the most heroic in society at the moment are teachers. And
okay.
If I said, I'm sorry, I'm a bit passionate about this stuff. I just, having been a teacher in the 60s and been involved with schools all my life, I just think that it's time we imagine them differently and get the corporate reformers who know nothing about education, get them out. They shouldn't be there.
Right. Exactly. Folks, I know Denny a little bit, and I can tell you, if you didn't hear it in her voice, the emotion, the extreme concern that she has for both the planet and for our public schools, and the call to action to all of us to start thinking and acting in ways to challenge the corporate state and their neglect of both our public schools and the planet. Again, you may have heard her voice maybe crack a little bit with emotion. That's exactly what happened at the TED Talk. And that's one of the main reasons I was blown away. The passion, the emotion is off the chart. You think I'm passionate? I pale in comparison. Ricardo.
Your talk.
I think I told you, but let me say it right here for the world to hear. I was blown, just like Denny, I was blown away with your talk. And one of the reasons was that I didn't expect the type of talk that you gave. For some reason, I thought it was going to be in the pedagogy area, and you came out. And folks, he nailed his talk. He talked about neoliberalism, which we had spent 5 weeks just before our talk last Wednesday, Ricardo. We spent 5 weeks talking about neoliberalism, or the neoliberal-driven war on public education. And so when I heard you pivot to that area, I went, holy excrement. I don't think I need to talk. I can just get up and go back to Los Angeles. You nailed it. Let's talk about you. Tell us a little bit about you, and then let's get into your talk.
Sure. Well, my name is, first of all, thank you very much for this invitation, James. I appreciate it. And also, thank you immensely to Jesse Turner, who's always been one of my heroes in education, for introducing and connecting us. So my name is Ricardo Rosa. I'm a member of Save Our Schools, as well as United Out Doubt and the Badass Teachers of Color organization. I'm also a professor at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. I've published two books. One is called Pedagogy in the Age of Media Control, Language Deception and Digital Democracy. And the second book is called, just released this year, it's called Capitalism's Educational Catastrophe and the Advancing Endgame Revolt. And the second book was written with my brother, as well as, Seresta Smith, Becky Smith, and some great other activists in the field, as well as Noam Chomsky, the very last chapter. So those are my two books, and it certainly isn't about selling them, but it's about sort of getting these works out there and these arguments out there is my main concern. But I very much appreciate the passion and the voice of Denny Taylor as well. I mean, so much of what she said just now definitely resonates with where I'm coming from. And my talk was on neoliberalism, but it was also focused more squarely on the issue of high-stakes testing. There's a lot of talk about bullying in education today. And, to talk about bullying yet accept this form of bullying, high-stakes testing I see as an extreme form of bullying, is a contradiction, a hidden curriculum, if you will, at its best, high-stakes testing is a bullying program in schools, and it's extremely abusive. I feel that, we shouldn't waste our time on trying to come up with a better test. There's no such thing as a test that's worth teaching to. And as Denny said, what we need in our schools is a greater ethic of care and more creativity, So that's where I went with my speech for the most part. I strongly believe that neoliberalism or market fundamentalism, if you will, and by that I mean, the rise of supply side innovation and competition, the reduction and destruction of the power of labor, the protection of capital, the reduction in state intervention when it comes to development and social welfare, the further decimation of the third world, deregulation and privatization. All of these themes or practices in neoliberalism, as well as high-stakes education and high-stakes testing, amounts to me as nothing more than a whiteness protection program, which I mentioned in my speech. Now, I don't mean to sort of shock people by saying that, but I strongly believe that, we need to name these things for what they are. I believe that a tremendous amount of what goes into educational policy today is deeply racist. And I feel that no social condition, will ever change, if we fear naming it. We have way too many rhetorical devices that are used in our culture to dissuade us from naming these things. And I think that if we don't name it, we risk building a new reform environment that will continue to marginalize people of color and ritualize white supremacy, class warfare, and patriarchy in our institutions. And, I don't feel that it's just about racism. I do think that it's also a class issue as well as an issue of patriarchy. So that's where I went with most of my speech. I connected neoliberalism and high-stakes education to racism by looking at the history of its genesis, so to speak. High-stakes testing came about in the early 1900s, and the roots were in the eugenics movement, which was a pseudoscience in which people who are white were understood to be genetically superior to people of color. And this goes way back. If you look at, the earliest efforts in American educational history to standardize education, I'm talking about the Committee of Ten in 1892, and so forth and so on. All of these committees were actually, closely connected to the eugenics movement. We already know about sort of the sterilization laws, with Indiana being the first state to pass it in 1907. These laws were directed first to people who are disabled, and then it was oriented towards the poor and people of color. But we tend to forget that eugenics was also oriented towards cultural erasure. you know, as Milan Kundera so powerfully reminded us, you know, the first steps, you know, in liquidating a people is to erase its memory. The struggle against power is the struggle of memory against forgetting. Lewis Terman, in the early 1900s, advocated the use of high-stakes tests, meaning, you know, these are tests that were tied to decision-making about extreme policies in schools. Paul Popenoe and Roswell Johnson believed that no child should escape inspection. And so this is the birth, really, of high-stakes testing movement in education. And if, you know, if we theorize education to mean something more than what happens in the four walls of schools, then we can probably historicize this stuff, you know, much further. But this is the history, you know, of high-stakes testing, and history matters. You know, as I pointed out in my talk, you know, we would never attempt to understand what's going on between the United States and Cuba today without looking to the past and understanding how that policy was formed way back. But we routinely, you know, do this in education, where we enact all of these policies and we don't look at the history of these policies. So those are, you know, the history, I think, squarely positions high-stakes testing, you know, as a racist practice. But I think the effects of high-stakes testing is also important for us to understand. You know, we're talking about school closures. We're talking about gentrification of communities of color. We're talking about the redesign of urban landscapes so as to move wealth upward. I mentioned that there's a tremendous amount of real estate wheeling and dealing that goes on in these things. And, you know, for a brilliant, you know, look at how high-stakes testing and what currently goes on in educational policy is connected to land development, I would urge your listeners to look at the work of Pauline Lipman. She's done brilliant work on this matter in Chicago. You know, schools are becoming increasingly punitive, you know, due to a high-stakes culture. You have students of color disproportionately suspended as a result of these high-stakes tests. You have school counselors being cut, therapists being cut due to funding for the testing industrial complex. And it's, you know, if you look at all of these effects, you know, the labeling and stigmatizing of children by making them eligible for special education, if you look at all of these effects, you know, it amounts to a tremendous amount of racism. But again, it's not just race. It's also about class and gender. But I begin with race because these are the communities that I was raised in, and it's where my analysis begins.
You see, people, why when I heard Ricardo's talk, I didn't have any more to say. He had taken my thunder. Ricardo, I don't know if you listened to this show in the past, but a couple of things come to immediate mind of minds is that one, in the very, very, very beginning of this series back in 18, 19 months ago when we first started, one of the things that I talked about and I talk about all the time is Edmund Burke's statement. Mm-hmm. Those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it. I have used that over and over and over again. You don't know this, but I have spent decades studying the eugenics movement, particularly as it was manifested in World War II Germany. That's where it got me started, both as a social psychologist and as a sociologist, a person who spent his life studying human behavior. And I tell my audience here that I look at human behavior. And one of the things I look at, of course, is why do we do the things that we do as well as the things that we do? And it's that why that baffled me. I could never understand how anyone could just kill people, unarmed people, children even, and even in war, some of the more hideous acts of killing children, running over them, laying them on the ground and running over them with tanks. We're talking about babies, throwing them up in the air and bare netting them. I have never been able to understand how anyone could do this. And I spent decades and a lot of money buying books and reading, etc. And eugenics was the general explanation that people were giving, and I studied it from sociology, psychology, social psychology, history, political science, you name it. And just a few months ago, one morning as I was getting up, it came to me why I could not understand it and all that effort that I had been trying to put into understanding it. And it was very simple, because I could never do those things. I could not understand why someone else could. And that was the missing link. And I haven't talked about it in depth in the show. I plan to. But you did, and you did a marvelous job, and that was one of the first things that said to me, I knew you and I had talked about you coming on the show, but that was, I got to get him to sit down and have a conversation with me about eugenics, its history. And Wayne Ogg up at University of Washington in Seattle, he's also studied this quite a bit. And so
we'll have
that conversation. We'll have the conversation. Now, you said Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I want you to go ahead.
No, I just mentioned that Wayne is a dear friend. We actually studied together at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Oh, cool. That should make it even better.
One of the things that I think, I agree with Ricardo, and I agree with both of you. This remembering and forgetting, to me right now, that is such a part of the corporatization of public education, in that so much of the work that was going on at the end of the 60s into the 70s and early 80s in public schools, where teachers had much more autonomy and were focused on trying to address issues of equality, all of that work has been washed out, so that you have NCGQ, who is actually many of my friends, including myself, we are not on reading books, on reading lists for courses in schools of education. So some of the most extraordinary work that was done at that time has, first of all, it was squashed, but now it's actually eliminated. And we have a whole generation of teachers and young scholars who are great, who are now working in schools, who have no experience of that time when there was so much energy spent on trying to minimize the gap between African-American and white students. And the data is pretty clear that the teachers were doing a really amazing job at narrowing the gap. I heard this morning on the radio that in the 70s, they were far more African-American young men going into medicine than there is today. The number is very small. And there was this, I don't think it was that effective, but there was an attempt made at the grassroots level to try and address the issue. And that work is just lost. It's not read. It's not used in courses. And we have a whole new generation of teachers who did not have those kinds of experiences in school.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think that the whole call to privatization actually intensified in the 60s as civil rights organizers, you know, began to look at educational policy as a way to address racial inequality, no doubt about it. You know, and I think the whole attack on older workers is actually not I mean, the reasoning behind it is not that workers are not performing up to par, but rather that these are folks that have a historical memory of a time that, you know, of policies that are not neoliberal in nature, you know. So I think this is one of the reasons why you have to get rid of these folks, you know, and bring in people who know nothing but the current policy that we have in place.
And I think it's the driving force behind my work is that I am really I'm really focused on making sure that we capture some of the work that was done in the second half of the 20th century that is lost. The great women scholars, as well as looking across class, race, and gender. I mean, these are critical issues, and I agree with you, everything that you said, Ricardo, with regard to race. I mean, it's inherent, it's structural, and the structure of the society is going to have to change if we're going to overcome it. I mean, I think we can teach the next generation to fight. That's the sweet honey in the rock song. We teach each generation to fight racism. But we've got to do more than that. We have to look at the inherent structure of society and how it perpetuates racial discrimination. And I don't know what the answer is. I just know that we have to keep talking about it and keep working at it.
Well, Denny, I won't be as bold as to say I know what the answer is, but you alluded to it in your talk when you were telling us about what your talk was about, and it was one of the things that I remember from your talk that I wanted to make sure you shared with us, and that is when you emphasize the fact that we, the people, have it in our hands, the fate of humanity and the planet.
And I fundamentally believe that.
I do too. If we don't wake up, that's the awareness part of my paradigm, and understand this, that's the second part of it, both awareness and understanding at the critical level, get emotionally involved with this awareness and understanding to the point we get pissed off, however you want it, and then take appropriate social action to bring about some real positive social change. In this regard, I have linked what I just said to the need to save public education. I can link it to what you just said in terms of saving the planet, and that the corporate state financial power elite will not do it. It is not in their interest. They would rather see both humanity and the planet go extinct as long as they can accumulate this unforeseen, ungodly amount of wealth that they probably think they will be able to survive it because they will have the best and the brightest figuring out a way how to either live on Mars, and I don't know why you're going to take all that money with you on Mars, but anyway, they don't care, and it's up to us and the schools. And your role of public education that you refer to over and over again. So it's us saving both our public education and schools and the planet. So there is a tie. And it's through our public education and our schools that we can educate the generations to come of both the war of today, where we are at their time, and what we have done or have not done, and what they're going to need to do if there's still time for something to be done. So we come full circle
on that. I do think it isn't too late for us to address these issues. And scientists are very clear about that, in that we have the capability to respond to anthropogenic change that's occurring. They are adamant that unless the laws of physics rule something out, we have the capacity to alter course, however difficult that might be. And I think the thing that you're referring to is, and I say this over every day, is that for the sake of our kids, we cannot lose hope. Despair paralyzes us, and we have to give it up. We can't despair. We've got to keep going. And hope is the essence of human existence. And what inspires me every day is ordinary people, many of them teachers, in fact, I would say most of them teachers, young people, you know, old people, you, me, Ricardo, is that we're incredibly good at reaching beyond what we think we're capable of doing and becoming heroic when we're confronted by life-threatening, catastrophic events. I mean, that's a thread going through all of the work I've done on catastrophes, is that it's ordinary people who step up and really make a difference when terrible events occur. I mean, it was the teachers after Katrina that took in kids who went into the shelters and organized them. And it was teachers who removed all the debris from schools and sent out notices and said to bring your children here. It didn't matter if that was their school, it didn't matter to the teachers. What they said was, bring them here and we will work with them. And so I was in schools right after Katrina where children were coming in with their parents and they were making sure with the little ones that they had their names on them and where they and their parents' names. They were dropping their kids off and the teachers were getting them involved in stories and singing and all kinds of wonderful activities to help them cope with what was happening in the community. And it's that.
Lydia, I'm gonna have to comment.
I'm sorry, but I was gonna say that's the piece that is inspiring.
I want to get Ricardo in, folks. I'm not going to tell you about my talk because I'd rather have the time for our guests to talk about their talk and for us to have a conversation over it. I'll get to you sometime either next week or the week after to tell you about my show. Ricardo, we got a couple minutes. Anything you want to add? Because I want to take the last
I strongly feel the resonance here with both of you in speaking about the need to take social action. You know, I think that that's key. In my talk, I didn't speak too much about alternatives to high-stakes testing because I didn't have that much time. But alternatives include, for example, portfolio assessments, small class sizes, and so forth and so on. But for me, you know, I think the greatest alternative in our educational system is really to have folks in it who have a greater ethic of care, and who deeply understand the lived experiences of community and deeply reflect on their own sort of identities, ideologies, and so forth and so on. Our real call to action, you know, when it comes to the issue of high-stakes testing is to opt out and to refuse these tests. And an organization that's brilliant at doing that is United Opt Out, so I'd highly encourage listeners to navigate, you know, United Opt Out site, to join United Opt Out, to join Save Our Schools and the Badass Teachers Association, and to be active, you know, in your respective unions. I think that, resisting testing in corporate schooling, though, is not enough. I think we also need to cut off the source of corporate schooling, which is capitalism. I think we need to really think seriously about alternatives, you know, to the current form of capitalism that we practice. And I closed, you know, my talk at the TED Talks with Bertolt Brecht's poem, The German War Primer, where he states, "General, your tank is a strong vehicle. It breaks down a forest and crushes 100 people, but it has one fault. It needs a driver." And so, we fuel, you know, the ruling elite's power whenever we just close our doors and teach, whenever we maintain fidelity to sort of the script, and whenever we obey. You know, if we know that it's wrong, but we continue staying silent, you know, we are actually complicit, you know, in educational malpractice. So I strongly feel that we need to withdraw our consent, refuse to drive, you know, this oppressive system. And I, too, am very inspired by critical teachers who do this every day.
Fantastic, folks. Fantastic. My talk echoes some of what both Denny and Ricardo has told you today. And I would love to be able to give it to you now. I'll just say this. We had 15 minutes. And you know, it took me 18 months to prepare to launch us into the critical part of what this show is all about, and that is the privatization of everything and everyone via the neoliberal agenda that we call the Machiavellian agenda. I worked on my talk for 7 months only to change total direction 2 weeks before the talk, because many of you who have written me via emails or be it Facebook, what have you, you're all expecting me to talk about the war report themes that we talk about here every week for the last almost 2 years now. That was going to be part of my talk, but I wanted to go to the what I consider the biggest issue and concern that I have for all of the humanity and the planet. And so I had written this maybe somewhat of an original talk, original statement, and I abandoned that so that I could go to where most people were expecting me to go. I worked on that, I don't say day and night because, you know, I was traveling, blah, blah, getting ready to come here and all that stuff. I want to tell you something. Hours before I was to head out to the university from Jesse's home, I had my talk finally together to try and get it into that 15-minute range. When I got there, as I said earlier, Ricardo and Denny, what they were all talking about and what you guys were expecting me to talk about, I changed my talk at the podium. I did. Some of what I said was what I was going to say from that my second effort to put together a talk, but I changed it, and I'll hopefully be able to tell you about it later. I just wanted to get that out there. Guess we've got another 6 minutes left on the show. I ask you to stick around. I'm doing something on all my shows while I'm on the road. I take the last 10 minutes and I tell my audience about the last week up to the day of the show so that they'll know what's going on and all that kind of stuff. So I'm going to take the last 5 minutes here and give them an update. I hope you stick with me. Let me launch into this. Starting with the TED Talk. I just told you about that. After the TED Talk, some of us went out to have dinner. And it was at the dinner that one of the people who was at the TED Talk who was in the audience, Rose Reyes, said that she was going that coming Saturday to a one-day conference in Massachusetts. It was like a labor conference and a workshop. And I decided, along with the urging of Jesse, that it was unscheduled, but I would go to it as well. So Thursday, made the plans to go there, worked on getting ready to start actually collecting the data all across everywhere. Saturday morning, Jesse drove me down to another place here in Connecticut where I met with Rose Reyes, and she in turn took me into Massachusetts. I don't remember where it was. Worcester, I think it was Worcester, Massachusetts. I'm not sure. Folks, I've been to so many places, I don't have a clue. At this conference, Barbara Maloney was the keynote speaker. I have had efforts to talk, meet Barbara and talk to her in the past and get her on the show. It never happened. At the conference, after she did her talk and the audience broke up and went to the little workout shops, I had a chance to meet Barbara Maloney. We had a fabulous, fabulous talk. And Ricardo, she remembered me and knew about me because of your efforts to let her know that I was coming to Boston in this past week or so. And she remembered the efforts that I had made to get us to talk. That coincidence, not quite, because I went there because I knew she was going to be there, but the outcome was totally amazing. Talking to her, she wanted me to, at lunchtime, join her group of teachers who were there, and I did at lunchtime, and that was fabulous. The result was that we mapped out, in broad terms, what I'm going to do when I get to Massachusetts. And they were all livid that must do Boston, and they named off two, three other communities, upstate, downstate, around state, so many so that I said I couldn't get to all of those, that I'd do Boston, and I would pick one more area to hopefully be able to get to. It was an incredible time for me in that the people I was talking to, the three teachers that I was talking to, I'll give you their first names, Mary, Patrick, and Heidi, all veteran teachers. Mm-hmm. And they were all telling me their stories as if I was collecting the data right there. Their stories were fabulous. It is the kind of stuff that I want to get on tape to share with the world. And they all want to be interviewed when I come back to Massachusetts. They, other teachers that they wanted me to hopefully include on the interview schedule. And they all want to help in any way possible to be my team on the ground so that I can, you know, get places and all the things that I need when I get to a location. And Barbara herself made the same commitment that she and whatever she could do with the best members of her team would also do the best that they can to make my visit to Boston an overwhelming success. That was huge, really huge. And I thank you, Ricardo, for getting to her and getting the word to her, as well as Gus Morales. And it looks like it's going to work out better than we all hope, Ricardo and Gus and Jesse. I left Boston with Rose, came back to her town, city, where she had arranged for one young teacher friend of hers to put me up for the night. And this young man lives in a house with five other people. I met five of them. And all of them are young teachers who are currently teaching or future teachers. One will be graduating with a BA in December. The other one will be getting his master's in May. But they all are teachers and want to be teachers. And we spent the night last night, like you do in college when you stay up all night. Well, I didn't stay up all night. Talking about the issues, talking about what's wrong with education. And get this, folks, you won't believe this. Two of the teachers were former Teach for America people. Yeah, I was in a room with Teach for America people. You know how I feel about that. But it was fabulous. The other two who are going to go into teaching when they graduate were thinking about going in Teach for America to be able to get into public school teaching. Here in Connecticut, they have a really, really tough system for you to get into education and get your credential. Teach for America is exempted from all of those requirements. You go to Teach for America, you can start teaching right after you get your BA, and blah. I'm speeding up because my time is running out. Bottom line was, it was fabulous. each of the young people that I talk to, I'm going to get back to their city. I'm going to hopefully interview a couple of them and some more young teachers. So this past week, since we last talked, has been fabulous. And one other thing, I'm still cold as hell. I'm freezing, folks, but I'm having a good time. Miss you all. See you next week. Oh, next week I'm in Maine. Remember, that came about 2 weeks ago, and it's worked out. I'm leaving here Friday morning, getting to Maine late or afternoon Friday. We'll hopefully start doing the interviewing Fridays. We'll stay there Sunday. The show will come from Maine Sunday. May stay over Monday, possibly Tuesday. And right now, Ricardo, it looks like I'm going to leave Maine coming to Boston. Not coming back to Connecticut, but coming to Boston. I'll be in touch with you either later today or tomorrow. My time is up. Thank you, Doug, for letting me have an extra minute. And with that, I'll say goodbye, and we'll get together next Sunday.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.